catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind the scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Last year, in January, we published a single absite review, and due to the anxiety of residents nationwide, it was very popular. So we thought this year it would be good to go back and do a little bit more detailed absite review to help all of you prepare for the absite. Just as a disclaimer, none of this is actual absite material. We don't have any special access or permissions, but we're just going over sort of the score key objectives in the score portal and covering those here, and hopefully they will come in handy on the absite.
Yeah, so these are things we put together as we were studying for the absite. We thought it was beneficial. We wanted to share it with you guys. Let us know what you want to hear. You know, we're really just kind of trying this out. So let us know what you think and any ideas you could have for making this better. We really want to, you know, help everybody out there prepare for the absite. So,
and if you've made any of your own absite reviews, we'd be happy to use those to help record some other episodes, as this is all material we're putting together on our own. So
the topic today is we're going to start with esophagus, and if we have time, get into a little bit of, you know, gastric and gastroesophageal reflux. So we'll start with just some, you know, basic anatomy. So looking at the esophagus, Kevin, looking at the vagus, you have the right vagus, left vagus. Which one travels anterior? Which one travels posterior?
Right, and this has to do with the way the stomach rotates when it's outside of the abdomen. So it's actually the right vagus will be on the posterior of the esophagus. And this actually turns into the celiac plexus. And what is important to know about the celiac plexus coming from the right vagus is that when you're doing a vagotomy on a patient, if you don't divide all the branches of the celiac plexus, there'll be the branch known as the criminal nerve of Grassi that will cause persistent hyper acid state. So you want, when you're doing a vagotomy, it's the right vagus which can cause the persistent hyperacid state.
And then you're looking at, so right vagus goes posterior, left vagus goes anteriorly. Off the right vagus comes the criminal nerve of Grassi, as Kevin said. Off the left vagus, which travels anteriorly, you have your branches to the liver and the biliary tree, the hepatic branches. And these are important to try and preserve when you're doing, when you're taking down gastrohepatic ligaments and when you're, you know, doing your Nissens and your Links and all those procedures, to be able to identify that hepatic branch and preserve it. Next, we're going to go over some of the, you know, very highly testable different findings on manometry and how this relates to different disease processes of the esophagus. So, John, so your patient goes and gets manometry and it shows a high lower esophageal sphincter pressure and absence of peristalsis. What's your diagnosis?
Well, when you have a high LES pressure and then you don't have any peristalsis, I would be thinking achalasia in this patient.
Right, that's your burnout esophagus, achalasia. The absence of peristalsis is very important there. And then next, so you have high amplitude, repetitive, non-peristaltic contractions. So high amplitude, repetitive, non-peristaltic contractions. What's that?
That would be esophageal spasm. When you look at it on the manometry, oftentimes these readings are very chaotic and they don't appear any way associated with the other ones.
Now, on the contrary, you have very high amplitude, but it is peristaltic contractions. What's that diagnosis?
That would be nutcracker esophagus.
Okay. And how about when you don't have any peristalsis and then you have a lower esophageal pressure, and then together with reflux?
So you think of it as two negatives, the aperiostalsis as well as the low LES pressure. You should be thinking scleroderma in these patients, and they do have the massive reflux like you talked about.
Right. So again, distinguishing that on manometry from achalasia is very important to know that lower esophageal sphincter pressure. If both are low, scleroderma. If you have a burnout esophagus with a high LES pressure, achalasia.
And definitely take a look in your textbooks, whichever textbook you use, and just get a glance at these manometry charts, because they can be very high yield.
And Kevin, speaking of achalasia, what causes that? What's the what's the ultimate, you know, end pathogenesis of that?
So it's thought to be a destruction of the myenteric plexus. So you lose the neuronal ganglion cells.
Okay. And bonus points, what pathogen causes that?
Is that Cruzi one?
Yeah, Trypanosoma cruzi, I think is if anybody ever read that book, what was that, Microbiology for Idiots or whatever, back in med school, it's Tom Cruise, T. Cruzi. I don't remember exactly. I know the mnemonic had something to do with Tom Cruise. But anyway.
And I'll never forget. But it's not all patients that have achalasia have Tom Cruise theory in them, right?
Right, not at all.
It's just that can be a way you get achalasia.
Yeah, okay. What's the treatment for that?
So a lot of, at least on the testable answers, you'll generally start with some balloon dilations. You can also try some calcium channel blockers and nitrates. And then it'll proceed to a Heller myotomy. And some of the fancier centers nowadays are doing the POEM procedure for achalasia, per-oral endoscopic myotomy. But I think for the test, if there's a surgery, it'll be Heller myotomy.
Yeah, you know, I think you start off with some medical treatments, calcium channel blockers, nitrates, if that doesn't work, you know, then they're moving on. You know, more and more in younger patients, people who are good surgical candidates, you go straight for the Heller. It's a more durable treatment for this, and kind of skip the balloon dilation. But certainly if there's any question of their, you know, being a good operative candidate, they undergo some balloon dilations. You know, and John, can you describe a little bit what the principles of the Heller myotomy are?
Yeah, I actually just got this in one of my mock oral scenarios. So you make an incision that should extend 2 centimeters below the GE junction and then 5 to 7 centimeters proximal to the GE junction. And then you separate the muscle layers laterally to prevent rehealing. So you go through both sets of muscle layers and then you do a partial fundal wrap to avoid additional reflux.
And then invariably, they're going to give you that you make a mucosal injury, you're making an esophageal injury during your Heller myotomy. What do you do in that situation?
So generally, you close it and you rotate the esophagus 180 degrees and perform your Heller myotomy on the other side.
Yeah, and then typically you'll do a partial fundal wrap too as well over
and
that.
Jason, what partial fundal wrap is the classic description?
I believe it is the toupee. I don't know, do you know?
I just thought you'd know because you're pretty smart.
Well, I mean, your options are either to do a toupee or a door fund application. And the way I always remember those is, you know, toupee goes on the back, like on the back of the head, a toupee. And then, you know, with a door, you shunt your front door. So door is an anterior wrap and a toupee is your posterior wrap.
And what's the thought behind not performing a Nissen in these patients, a full Nissen? From my understanding, it's that it'll, you know, these patients have dysphagia and the incidence of dysphagia after Nissen is too high in these patients. So the door or the toupee would not be at high of risk for dysphagia.
Yeah. We'll get into this a little bit more when we're talking about our Nissens, but it's very important before you do a full wrap to document that they have normal esophageal motility. It's frowned upon to do a full wrap in anybody who has any evidence of any type of esophageal dysmotility.
So this is a topic that I always find interesting because it's one of those kind of like the Minn syndromes, highly tested, rarely seen diseases. But so John, you know, you got this patient, they come in, they have halitosis and they have some dysphagia. You perform a barium swallow on them in the upper esophagus. There's this little outpouching. What are we dealing with and what is the pathogenesis for this?
So I'd be thinking of a Zenker's diverticulum and that is caused by ineffective relaxation of the cricopharyngeus muscle. And this is typically found in Killian's triangle. For all you high achievers out there, that Killian's triangle is the triangular area in the wall of the pharynx between the thyropharyngeal and the cricopharyngeus of the inferior constrictor of the pharynx. You probably don't need to know that for abcite, but good to know. Jason, is this a true or false diverticulum?
So this is a false diverticulum as it, you know, kind of herniates through the muscle layers, and the diverticulum itself only contains the mucosa. Typically, you make the diagnosis of these, you know, as Kevin said, you have somebody comes in with, you know, dysphagia, they have bad breath. Sometimes the diagnosis is made after a perforation, after following an EGD. But the test you want to order is a barium swallow or a gastrograph and or a thin barium swallow.
And the critical part in the surgery is that you have to have a cricopharyngeal myotomy. So you can remove the outpouching whichever way you prefer, endoscopically open and remove the outpouching. But if you don't relieve the pressure of the cricopharyngeus, it's going to recur. So you have to have a cricopharyngeal myotomy.
Okay, moving on. So let's talk about some other highly tested esophageal topics. One would be the hiatal hernias. So let's go real quick through. There's, you know, four types of hiatal hernias. John, what's type one?
Type one is when you have the GE junction herniates above the diaphragm, and it's only the GE junction. Type two is a paraesophageal hernia where the GE junction is actually in a normal position, but you have part of the stomach that herniates up through the hiatus.
And type three?
Type three is a combination of one and two where you have both the GE junction and a portion of the stomach up through the hiatus.
And type four?
And type four is a type three, plus you have additional organs such as the colon up into the through the hiatus.
Yep, and that's the most. I was going to ask you beat me to it. What's the most common organ you're going to see up there? And it's usually the colon. So what constitutes, for bonus points, what constitutes a giant hiatal hernia?
I think that's when you have at least 30% of the stomach in through the chest, and I've seen this once.
Yep, exactly. 30%
of
the stomach.
I think it was your patient, Jason.
Yeah, probably. Probably one of my failures as a repeat hiatal hernia, was it? Okay, moving on. So the next topic would be, next high-yield topic for esophagus, we're moving on to Barrett's esophagus. So what is the definition? What constitutes a Barrett's esophagus?
So it's important to know simple histology of the esophagus and of the stomach. The esophagus histology is the mucosa is generally squamous mucosa, whereas the stomach, it's a columnar epithelium that can secrete, the columnar cells can secrete fluid. So the squamous epithelium of the esophagus becomes, like the stomach, becomes columnar. So that classifies as metaplasia, and we are not pathologists by any means, but this is the surgery understanding of this disease process.
So what's the role of Nissen's with Barrett's esophagus? I know there's a lot of controversy out there. What's the current standing? Should we be performing Nissen's for Barrett's or not?
I should have re-listened to the Dr. Hunter episode where he, the chief of surgery at OHSU, that covers this in detail. But I believe the gist of it is that a Nissen is in a patient that has Barrett's is not going to reverse the Barrett's esophagus, but it's going to stop the progression, or at least prevent any further progression of disease.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a hard thing to study in the first place, because Barrett's, you know, the natural history of Barrett's isn't well understood. A lot of it regresses kind of on its own, so it's difficult to study whether or not a particular intervention has any effect. But yeah, everybody should go back and listen. If you want to get more details into that, go back and listen to the prior podcast we have with Dr. Hunter and others. So how about with Barrett's esophagus, what's the, you know, how do you treat these patients? Let's say you have Barrett's esophagus, you have metaplasia, but no dysplasia. What do you want to do with that patient, John?
Well, like you said, Jason, it depends on the level of dysplasia that you have in a specific patient. For a patient that has no dysplasia, you can do surveillance endoscopy every 3 years and check for any progression.
Okay, and how are you doing that surveillance? Are you taking biopsies?
Well, typically you do your typical EGD and you do your circumferential biopsies of the GE junction.
Yeah, and can you describe a little bit more about that? You want to take?
I believe it's 1 centimeter circumferentially, and then I forget exactly how much you take above and below.
So basically, you want to take four quadrant biopsies at 1 centimeter intervals through your abnormal appearing esophagus for surveillance. And how about if you see a low grade dysplasia?
For low grade dysplasia, although there is some new literature on this, there's endoscopic eradication. So your coagulation or your endoscopic mucosal resection, also known as EMR. And then for these patients, you now surveil them much closer than you do with a patient who has no dysplasia.
And what about, let's go on to high-grade dysplasia. So now you have a biopsy that shows high-grade dysplasia on your Barrett's patient. How are you going to treat that patient?
So it depends if you're a high-speed resident at the University of Washington or some fancy place, but for the absite and for our mock orals and things like that, high-grade dysplasia, the chances of there being a missed carcinoma within that tissue is very high. I think it's 20-30%. So you get two pathologists to agree that it is high-grade dysplasia because it does vary between pathologists, and then they'll generally get an esophagectomy is the board answer. And in practice, we're seeing more of the endoscopic mucosal resections and kind of tumor board discussions, but for the test, high-grade dysplasia, esophagectomy.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually not sure how I would answer that question. How I would answer that question if I got it today. I mean, certainly, you know, the confirmation with two pathologists is essential. I don't know. I think it's getting so prevalent that I think if EMR were on the test, if I had between that and esophagectomy, I might choose the EMR. I may be wrong, but that might be what I would choose.
But thankfully, there's not questions like this on the absite.
Not yet.
So they'll never put a very controversial treatment algorithm. It'll be generally pretty clear.
And if it is, it may be one of those infamous test questions where they're testing out to see how people are answering. So don't get stressed out if you get that on the test. Okay, moving on. That's a nice segue into esophageal cancer. So, John, what's the most common esophageal cancer in the United States?
So when we think of esophageal cancer, we think of two types. You have your squamous as well as your adenocarcinoma. And the most common is the adenocarcinoma, and this occurs in the lower esophagus.
Yeah, this is this may be changing, you know, more recently. But what I was always taught is worldwide squamous cells are most common because it's associated with smoking. In the United States, you have adenocarcinoma is more common. And it's in the lower third, and it's associated with reflux and chronic inflammation there. That may be the epidemiology that is constantly changing. What do you want to do for a T1 tumor?
So for a T1 tumor, the absolute answer would be esophagectomy, although there is a role for endoscopic mucosal resection and T1 low-grade tumors.
Okay, and anything greater than a T1 tumor, what's the answer?
So you do preoperative chemo radiation for these patients prior to resection.
Right. Okay. So for T1, you can go ahead with the esophagectomy for T2, for some high grade T1s. But again, that's getting into the weeds, and you can go back and listen to, I think our Pellegrini episode talks about this stuff pretty in depth. But for abside, for T2 and above, you need neoadjuvant therapy. And how are we best, you know, when we're working these patients up, how are we going to determine the depth of invasion?
Well, similar to rectal cancer, the two modalities that we use to determine depth of invasion are endoscopic ultrasound as well as MRI, and they both have their advantages and disadvantages.
So, Kevin, how about you have somebody who's got a little dysphagia? So, Kevin, how about somebody a little dysphagia, and you get a swallow study, and it shows, you know, a well circumscribed, you know, mass in the mid portion of the esophagus that appears to be in the mid layers of the esophagus.
Yeah, I think this one would show up on the absite as like an actual image itself because it has a very characteristic crescent appearance on an esophagram. And so this is what they generally call a leiomyoma. It's located in the muscularis of the esophagus.
How are you going to confirm that diagnosis?
So you're not going to confirm the diagnosis. You're going to, based on imaging alone, you can take them to the operating room and perform an enucleation via a thoracotomy for this lesion.
Right. So, you know, you see it on your swallow, probably is the first way you're going to see it. You get your endoscopic ultrasound, you know, it looks like a well-circumscribed mass in the muscularis propria. You obviously need to get CT scanning. You need to make sure you're not dealing with anything malignant. But then you specifically do not want to biopsy these because the scar from the biopsy can make it the subsequent resection, enucleation, very difficult. So the treatment, the kind of the answer is the larger ones over 5 centimeters, or if they're causing any problems, they're symptomatic, you excise them through enucleation via a thoracotomy. Another one that kind of comes up that we don't deal with often is caustic esophageal injuries. So, you know, you have somebody coming into the ER who drank a bottle of Drano. What's your initial management? Or specifically, what don't you want to do with these patients, Sean?
So you should tell anybody taking care of this patient to do not place an NG tube. They should not induce vomiting these patients, and they obviously should be MPO.
Yeah, this is important. I mean, I've personally never had somebody come in drinking Drano, but I know this. I talked to somebody who this recently came up on either their mock orals or their actual boards. So you distinguish between alkali and acidic. Alkali, you know, the Drano example causes, there's two different kinds of necrosis. Which one does the alkali cause?
Alkali causes liquefaction necrosis.
And is that better or worse than an acidic?
There's a worse injury overall than the acid version.
And why is that? What kind of necrosis does an acid injury cause?
That causes coagulation necrosis, which would likely lead to a gastric injury. But the alkali necrosis is also more likely to cause an alkali injury is more likely to cause cancer.
To predispose that person to a later malignancy. So you want to get, you know, chest film, abdominal imaging, some axial imaging, looking for free air, signs of perforation. And what's the role of endoscopy?
So endoscopy is the best way to assess the lesion that you're dealing with. It's important to note that when you're doing your endoscopy, to go down to the level of the injury and do not try to push past it, because that would likely lead to a perforation in these patients.
Okay. And how about, so you do your endoscopy and you see what looks like a minor injury, just a little bit of hyperemia. What do you want to do with those patients?
So that'd be a primary burn. And these patients, I would just do observation and conservative therapy, including MPO, IV fluids, spitting, antibiotics, and then you can start oral intake after 3 or 4 days. And then these patients may actually eventually need serial dilations to recover from their strictures.
Yeah, so those with those minor injuries, treat conservatively, let it heal, and then deal with the ramifications afterwards. How about if you, on your endoscopy, you see some exudate, you see some ulcerations, it looks a little bit deeper.
So this would be a secondary burn. The treatment for these patients is prolonged observation and also conservative therapy. In these patients, you have to worry about a potential perforation and a need for esophagectomy. And what would lead you to doing that would be if a patient develops sepsis, peritonitis, mediastinitis, any free air, contrast, extravasation, pneumothorax, or a large effusion.
Yeah, so I mean, the overarching thing is, you know, if it's a more superficial injury, you try and treat it conservatively as much as you can, and then deal with the strictures down, let everything heal up. But you know, it's, if you have a perforation of your esophagus, you have a perforation of your esophagus. The patient is septic. You got to do what you got to do. So those patients are going to need it with an operation. You do damage control, you stabilize them, and you reconstruct them later. Going down that road a little bit further, or to the next step, dealing with the perforation. So what's the most common cause of perforation in the United States, Kevin?
Our overzealous endoscopist.
Yeah, so this is the patient that comes in, they had an EGD performed either earlier in the day, they're having some, you know, substernal chest pain and abdominal pain. Where's the most typical site of a perforation from an EGD?
I believe it's at the highest point of narrowing in the esophagus, which is the cricopharyngeus.
Okay. And so we get into the, you know, how do you, important thing is how are you first going to diagnose these patients? What study are you going to get? How are you going to confirm the diagnosis?
Well, generally, at least the way I've done them is there's nothing, you know, they might have like an effusion on a chest x-ray or something, but there's nothing too dramatic on chest x-ray other than that. So then you'll take them to do a gastrograph and swallow. And then if that's not diagnostic, you can give them a barium swallow. And what I've always seen is the gastrograph and swallow followed up by a CT scan, all in the same kind of setting to make sure to confirm. If you don't see anything dramatic on the swallow, you put them through the CT scanner and be a little more sensitive to picking up a perforation.
Yeah, that's a very key thing, is when you're looking for, obviously, if you're looking for a perforation, something with that there could be extravasation of contrast, you want to start with a water-soluble contrast. So water-soluble gastrographin. If that doesn't pick it up, you can't see it on your CT scan, and you can do thin barium. It's a little bit more sensitive, but it certainly always want to start off with something water soluble. You know, there are some patients with esophageal perforation that you will be able to manage conservatively. If it's a contained perforation, the patient's stable. You can treat them with NPO, IV fluids, and broad spectrum antibiotics. But the majority of the time, you're going to be dealing with a non-contained perforation, at least in the test-taking world. So, how are you going to deal with those patients? So, you have a free perforation in a distal esophagus. What's your approach?
Thankfully, I've gotten some practice at this after your patient that came in a couple weeks ago.
it's too soon.
So, generally, you're going to perform a left-sided thoracotomy, and you're going to wash out the chest. Then you're going to perform a longitudinal myotomy, and the key thing with the longitudinal myotomy is it has to be long in order to be able to identify the mucosal injury underneath. And also, I apologize, on your way in, you should be thinking about preserving some of the intercostal to perform a muscle flap. You can also use pericardium and sometimes diaphragm.
Sometimes omentum. It's just the key is you got to think about it ahead of time. When you're entering the chest, that's the time to think about raising the intercostal flap that you're going to use to buttress your repair. But yeah, absolutely agree. Left thoracotomy is generally going to be your approach. You have to see the extent of your mucosal injury. That's a key concept. So remember that when you're taking your tests, when you're taking oral boards, you have to see the extent of your mucosal injury. So you have to extend your myotomy. Okay, where are you going to go from there?
Then you're going to perform your repair in layers. So you will primarily repair the mucosa. Then you'll repair the muscularis. You'll perform your buttress. Then you'll widely drain the area with chest tubes, and you will get out of Dodge and closely monitor them in the ICU.
Yep, exactly. So repairing two layers, generally what they want to hear is what they're going for is you're using an inner layer of absorbable. So you close your mucosa with, you know, a 4-0 PDS, 4-0 or 5-0 PDS, something like that. And then you're going to repair your muscular layer with a permanent suture, something like silk, leave drains and get out of town. And then another thing you got to remember is you got to address the issue is why you're there in the first place. If it's an EGD, that's one thing. If they're getting an EGD for achalasia, you may have to perform a myotomy at the time. Certainly you have to take care of the reason that led to the perforation in the first place before you leave the operating room.
And just as a heads up for people that haven't taken the AbSight before, the AbSight questions are generally very straightforward. They're one-liners with A, B, C, D, each one word each are very small. So we're getting a little kind of into the oral board scenarios here, and we're going to kind of go back and forth. But I think it's okay to have a little greater depth of understanding for things, even though it's not exactly tested on the AbSight.
Yeah, for me, that's a good point. You know, the AbSight is very straightforward. They're not trying to trick you. For me, it helps to have a little bit of the better clinical context. It just helps me remember some of the details that are going to show up on the test. Just to, you know, finish up our esophageal review, let's go real quick, very briefly over gastroesophageal reflux disease. So these are patients that come to you typically with saying that, you know, the typical symptoms of having some heartburn, some, you know, water brash, you know, saying they're having maybe a little bit of regurgitation, especially when they lie down. But then there's other things that are a little bit more concerning that makes you want to, you know, think that you have to rule out if there's an underlying malignancy or something else contributing to their symptoms. So what are, when we talk about GERD, Kevin, what are the alarm systems of GERD that would need a little bit more investigation?
Right. These are the ones, like he said, that make you concerned for mass. Dysphagia, which is difficulty swallowing. Then you can have odontophagia, which is actually painful swallowing. And then certainly, if they have any weight loss, anemia, melena in their stool, all of these things would make you even more concerned. And all these things can be caused to some extent by just run-of-the-mill or severe GERD, but you would have to do a serious workup to rule out any malignancy in these patients.
So these patients pretty predictably get, you know, four key studies. And usually if a patient's being referred to the surgeon because of their gastroesophageal reflux, a lot of times the gastroenterologists have already performed these studies. But John, walk us through how you're going to work out this patient up.
So in no particular order, typically these patients first will get a barium swallow and then followed by an upper endoscopy, probably your first two studies that you usually get. And it's usually diagnosed on an upper endoscopy. But you also can get ambulatory pH testing as well as esophageal manometry for further workup.
Yeah, so this these tests give you a lot of information. So barium swallow, you can see a lot of masses. You can see reflux on the barium swallow. You can see if there's any anatomical abnormalities. You can see esophageal motility. Your upper endoscopy, you're going to be able to see if there's any esophagitis. You're going to be able to see if there's any masses. You're going to be able to do biopsies. Your pH testing is very important. We'll get into that a little bit here in a second, talking about your Demeester score and, you know, exactly if your patient's going to, you know, benefit from one of the surgeries we're going to talk about. And then your manometry, of course, it's important to document that patients have normal esophageal motility, especially if you're thinking about doing an anti-reflux surgery. So with regards to the pH testing, can you tell us a little bit of what are the components of a Demeester score and how does that weigh into who we choose to operate on?
Yeah, for the pH monitoring, essentially the patient we'll wear a pH probe that is oral taken down. There's also pH probes that can be adhered to the mucosa of the esophagus. But then you correlate these symptoms of the patient's GERD with the potential of having acidity less than 4. And the components can include the percent of the total time of pH less than 4, the total time of pH 4 during when their patient's sitting upright, the total number of pH 4, less than 4 when they're supine. And then you also look at the number of reflux episodes greater than 5 minutes in duration.
Yeah, a Demeester score over 14 indicates a reflux. Now, you're not going to have to know the details of this, especially for the AB site, but it's something to be aware of. It may show up in the stem of a question or something asking you what you want to do for a patient. So, Kevin, when we're talking about the surgical options for reflux, what are, you know, there's a lot of different procedures out there, but what are the overall goals for any anti-reflux surgery?
Right. So the thought is, especially if they have a hiatal hernia, like a type 1 hiatal hernia, you want to restore the normal anatomic position of the stomach and the GE junction. So if you have a GE junction that is intrathoracic and not intra-abdominal, there'll be negative pressures in the thorax that will allow reflux to occur. And so by placing the GE junction back into the abdomen, it recreates the anti-reflux valve that has naturally occurred. And so it's important, you know, like we were talking about earlier with the hiatal hernias, is that you make sure that you have you really have to mobilize enough of the esophagus so that the GE junction is comfortably within the abdomen. So, you know, you may be mobilizing 5-7 centimeters of esophagus up into the chest in a deep dark hole to ensure that you're going to have the GE junction resting comfortably within the abdomen to create that anti-reflux valve and to keep it in that position.
Yeah, I've heard people say that that's actually the most important part of a lot of these procedures is your mediastinal dissection, mobilizing that esophagus. Unfortunately, it's often the most overlooked part and potentially the part of the procedure that a lot of surgeons end up cutting corners on.
It's scary putting sticks up there.
It certainly is. It's not a comfortable place to be, especially if you're not there frequently. Okay, what next?
And then, of course, you know, GERD and hiatal hernias, we're kind of mixing them together here. But you assume that there is a defect in the diaphragmatic cura. So you have to approximate the cura generally with a permanent suture. And then sometimes, depending on the size of the defect, you may use like a biologic mesh in this position or potentially a lightweight polypropylene to help keep the cura approximated.
Yeah, I wouldn't get into the weeds on the AB side about what kind of mesh, if you're going to use a mesh, what kind of mesh, but certainly approximating the diaphragmatic cura is an important step. And then, you know, you want to make sure that you completely mobilize your fundus and perform, you know, that loose or that, yeah, that 2 centimeter, that floppy fund application performed over a large bougie. So we're talking 50 or 54 French.
And Jason, what happens if you can't get enough of the stomach intra-abdominal? What procedure can you perform?
Yeah, so they may be asked that. You need to get more esophageal length. You can perform a Colles gastroplasty, which is frequently described, rarely seen. And getting into the different types of wraps, I don't think you need to know too much about this, especially for the AB site. We already talked briefly about it. There's a full Nissen fund application, a 360 degree posterior flap from there. There's, you know, the transthoracic, the Belzy Mark IV. There's a door fund application, which, again, shut the front door. It's an anterior repair of 180 to 200 degrees. There's the toupee fund application, which is a posterior 270-degree flaps and wrap. And then there's the hill repair. But again, you know, these are all variants on a theme and not likely to need to know the details of them for the ab site. Important may show up in there is how to manage the post-op dysphagia. It's not uncommon for a lot of these patients to have a little bit of dysphagia. Generally, that will resolve with conservative management over, you know, a couple of 2 to 3 weeks as the swelling and edema goes down. But certainly if they present and they can't handle their own secretions and it's very significant, that may need an operation to take down. But for the most part, a little bit of dysphagia post-op is fine. As long as it'll resolve after the swelling kind of goes down. And then, John, how about you do your fund application and you get a chest x-ray in the PACU, and it shows, you know, 2 centimeter a capnothorax on the left side of the chest. What are you going to do with that? Do they need a chest tube?
These patients do not need a chest tube. Most likely this will resolve since it is CO2 inside the chest. If they are symptomatic, though, I would further evaluate.
Okay. So that kind of wraps up our, you know, our overall esophageal review. We're going to do a couple of kind of quick hits, a high yield anatomy facts here just at the end. So, John, why don't you lead us through some?
All right. So, Kevin, what are the layers of the esophagus? Well, I mean, these are the important parts of the that might be tested on an app site.
So, I like to correlate the esophagus and the rectum with regards to cancer and workup and things like that. But for the esophagus, is all you have is the mucosa and the muscularis.
Does it have a serosa?
No. The esophagus and the rectum do not have serosas.
And when we look at the blood supply of the esophagus, it obviously, based on its anatomy, does not come from all the same blood supply. So break it down for me, cervical, thoracic, and abdominal. Where does the cervical blood supply of the esophagus come from?
So the cervical supply, and I've, you know, heard rumor mills of people saying that they've seen questions like this on the ab site. So generally it's from the inferior thyroid artery, which, Jason, by the way, which parathyroids does the inferior thyroid artery supply?
Well, it supplies all 4 parathyroids, both the inferior and superior.
Boom. So yeah, it's got a lot of work to do. It's got to supply the superior esophagus. It's got to supply all the parathyroids. And then the middle of the esophagus is supplied by the direct branches off of the aorta. And then, Jason, how about the lower part of the esophagus, lower one-third?
So that comes off your phrenic arteries and your left gastric artery. So for bonus points, what are 2 other anatomic structures in the body that have a multi-level vascular supply?
Okay, Jason, we both missed it. Just tell us.
The bile duct and the ureters.
So what's the multi-level of the bile duct?
That's for a different episode.
It's because he doesn't know it.
And the last thing, Schottky's rings. Okay, so what are you going to do with a patient with a Schottky ring? What's the treatment?
So, you know, I've had these patients, they come in complaining of dysphagia, and you do the full workup, and they have a kind of isolated specific spot. Seen on the barium esophagram and on the EGD, with no masses associated with it. Unfortunately for these patients, you do not, well, fortunately or unfortunately, you do not do an esophagectomy for these patients. So you can just do dilations for these patients to help kind of disrupt the ring, either with a bougie or a balloon to help open up these Schottky rings. So, and then the anatomy of the thoracic duct is super high yield in all of surgery. And so a high yield anatomy point that you can see on the ab site is the thoracic duct. Can you tell us the course of the thoracic duct, Jason?
Yeah, sure. So it's a lymphatic duct. It originates in the abdomen. It forms a pathway called the cisternic hyoid. It passes up through the aortic hiatus and the diaphragm, and it crosses over from right to, well, first off, it runs between the thoracic aorta and the azygos vein. It crosses over at the level of T5 from right to left, and it ends up draining into the confluence of the internal jugular and the left subclavian.
Yes, and it can be easily damaged and can be a big problem.
Very difficult to manage.
Very difficult. Make them NPO and don't give them any fat. Okay, so that wraps up our first Absite review. These are still, we've decided we're actually going to be publishing these every week from now until the Absite. So if you guys have ideas, topics, we're going to try and, this week was kind of a clinical topic, esophagus. Next week we'll do a more basic science topic, and we'll kind of bounce back and forth as to not put you to sleep too much. So if you have any ideas of how we can make these better, or you have some review material you'd like us to use or help us out, feel free to send it to us, and we'd be happy to use it to help educate the masses, prepare for the Absite.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Well, thanks a lot, guys. And we'll, again, give us your ideas, and we're doing these for you. So let us know what we can do.
Until next time, dominate the day.